Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. So glad you can join me where I am every week right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com. and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. Support for this program comes from Travelers Championship, June 24th through 28th, TPC River Highlands. TravelersChampionship.com for more information. Well, the 126th U.S. Open is coming to our own backyard here in the Hamptons the week of June 15th. And few venues in golf can match the history and the prestige of Shinnecock Hills Golf Club. Founded in 1891, Shinnecock is the oldest incorporated golf club in the United States and one of the five founding member clubs of the USGA. It is also the only course to have hosted the U.S. Open in three different centuries. Unbelievable. Shinnecock hosted the second U.S. Open Championship back in 1896. At that point, only 35 players competed. And Shinnecock also hosted the second U.S. Amateur that same year. This will be the sixth U.S. Open contested at Shinnecock Hills. And I've had the privilege of covering the last four championships played here. Raymond Floyd's victory in 1986. I was a mere teenager. Corey Pavin's memorable win in 1995, Retief Guzin's triumph in 2004, and Brooke Koepka's successful title defense in 2018. The USGA has already awarded Shinnecock future championships, including the 2036 U.S. Open and the 2036 U.S. Women's Open, further cementing its place among the game's most iconic venue. It will be amazing to have the U.S. Women's Open at Shinnecock. What makes Shinnecock Hills such a compelling U.S. Open venue, at least one of the reasons, is that, you know, it's never lost its identity. While many championship courses have undergone dramatic changes through the decades, Shinnecock remains true to its roots as a classic links-style course. Its rolling fairways, the natural terrain, the fescue grasses, and the exposure to the winds off Peconic Bay create a challenge unlike any other in American golf. The course does not rely on tricks. It demands strategy. It demands patience, imaginations, and precision. Players must think their way around Shinnecock, managing the wind, controlling trajectory, accepting that even the best shots don't always get the best results. That's why so many champions and historians consider it one of the purest tests in the game. Well, this year's championship promises to be incredibly intriguing. The world's top players, led by Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau, and a host of others, will face a course that is expected to play firm and fast. The USGA has indicated it will take a lighter touch than in previous years, allowing Shinnecock's natural defenses to provide the challenge. For golf fans here on Long Island, it's also an opportunity to showcase one of our greatest treasures to a worldwide audience. Millions of viewers will once again get a glimpse of the beauty, the history, the championship pedigree that have made Shinnecock Hills one of the most revered clubs in the sport. Joining me today is Jack Druga, who served as head golf professional at Shinnecock Hills from 2007 through 2022. We'll talk about what makes this course such a formidable U.S. Open test, his experiences during the 2018 championship, and what players and fans can expect when the world's best return to Shinnecock. And Jack Druga, as the vice president of development and PGA ambassador for the Western Golf Association and the Evans Scholars Foundation. He will also talk about how young people can apply for these prestigious college scholarships. I know you will enjoy Jack's stories, his insight, and unique perspective on one of golf's most revered clubs. So stay with us. Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori. And Shinnecock Hills Golf Club in Southampton, New York, will host its sixth U.S. Open the week of June 15th. The course has a storied history, including being the lone course to have hosted the U.S. Open in three different centuries. Founded in 1891, Shinnecock Hills is the oldest incorporated golf club in the United States. And I have to say, it is a course close to my heart. Living on the east end of Long Island since the 90s, I have had the pleasure of playing Shinnecock many times with members through the years and covering it as a broadcaster, the U.S. Open, four different U.S. Opens, 1986, 1995, 2004, and 2018. So I look forward to the 2026 edition. My guest, Jack Druga, was the head golf professional at Shinnecock from 2007 to 2022 and was there for the 2018 U.S. Open, the last time the course hosted the tournament. And I have known Jack Druga for a long time. He has had a legendary career in golf with head pro jobs at the Creek Club in Locust Valley, New York, Loxahatchee in Jupiter, Florida, the Country Club of Fairfield in Connecticut, before his 16-year reign at Shinnecock. He has won many Met PGA Section Senior Tournaments, PGA Club Professional Championships, and played in the 1990 U.S. Open at Medina Country Club, and the 1977 and 1979 U.S. Amateur, and the 1976 Junior Amateur. Jack has served on many Met PGA Section and National PGA Committees and Boards, and he is now the VP of Development, PGA Ambassador for the Western Golf Association, and the Evans Scholars Foundation. And it is my pleasure to say hello to the great Jack Druga. Hey, Jack, welcome to Talking Golf.
Oh, thanks, Annie. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be on your show. You're right. We have known each other for a long time. I've admired your work and love your show. And yeah, exciting having the U.S. Open coming back to Shinnecock again. It seems like 2018 doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but here we are again.
I can't believe how fast it goes, but let's talk about 2018. What are your memories of that U.S. Open since you were the head pro there at Shinnecock?
Yeah, very exciting to be, exciting and quite an honor to be the host professional for a major championship in the U.S. Open. Shinnecock's a special site. Great memories. You know, it kind of starts about 3 years in advance with meetings with the USGA, prep, club committees, all the things that we had to get ready for that U.S. Open. And a lot of great memories. I mean, a lot of stories, a lot of great memories. One of the really fun things was hosting the tour players when they came in for practice rounds. My staff and I got to play quite a few practice rounds with some of the players who, many of the guys that I know, some of the players had relationships with my staff. Brooks Koepka went to Florida State. I actually had two assistants at the time. Kyle Jordan and Matt Cahill were Florida State students when Brooks was there. So that was kind of a fun thing for them. And just watching the young guys that hadn't been to Shinnecock get there for the first time, trying to learn the golf course in those practice rounds. Lots of great stories from those rounds.
So who'd you get to play with in the practice rounds?
Well, we set it up. There was a bit of a draft. The staff who were going to play with the guys drew out of a hat for their draft picks. And when someone called to set up a practice round, they could either say, yes, I want to play with that player, or defer to the next call. Except for Tiger, who I knew a little bit. I had played golf with Tiger when he was an amateur, so I had a relationship. But Tiger asked me to play with him, and I got to play with Tiger for two straight days, 36 holes, two straight days. I guess it was Memorial Day week because he definitely went to Memorial. But yeah, we 36 holes with him, fascinating about what he saw, what he did. He couldn't have been better with me, my staff, the members, everybody involved. It was really a fun 36 holes to play with him. And then, of course, he misses the cut, and everybody blamed me for my two playing lessons that I couldn't even get them over there on the weekend. So I guess those practice rounds didn't help Tiger as much as we thought they were going to help him. But he did go on to win the Masters the next year. So maybe it just took a little time for my coaching and teaching to kick in.
I love it. So how many questions did he ask you about the greens and about the golf course when you were playing with him those two practice rounds?
Yeah, well, he had played in the previous Open. But, you know, we had eight new tees. There was quite a few changes. There were some narrower fairways. There were eight new tees since he had last played. He asked me questions about prevailing winds, bounces, things like that, you know, I had been there, I guess, at that point, just over 10 years. And, you know, there's little things at Shinnecock, I think, that you can pick up. But he asked great questions. He really, I think his golf IQ obviously is higher than most. And he was really, really interesting to play with and really interesting about some of the things that he saw that I really hadn't thought about. He very much felt like you play a U.S. Open differently than you play other major championships. You try not to make a mistake in a U.S. Open. Pars are fine, and he knew that. And he was, you know, pars are going to be fine. If I happen to make a birdie, that's great. But yeah, fun for him to play with. He lives down here in Jupiter where I spend the winter. I run into him occasionally. But yeah, that was fun for me. The other great practice rounds, Phil Mickelson, Bryson DeChambeau, who was not quite Bryson yet, had a couple of great days with Mike Moynihan, one of my assistants. And wow, what an interesting young guy he is. He didn't play great in the tournament. He made the cut, but that was really my first experience around Bryson. And that was fun to get to know him a little bit.
And how about the guys who played with Brooks Koepka? Did they get a sense that, you know, this guy showed at that point, just showed up like nobody's business at the majors?
Yeah, you know, Annie, he didn't play until Wednesday. He got there late Tuesday. He hit some balls. He chipped and putted. So he really only played one round. He had never been there before. Same with a couple of the other guys that played well. Dustin Johnson had never been there before, and he only played 18 holes. Some of the guys really prepared. I understand. I'm sure you've heard, but at the Ryder Cup last year at Bethpage, the European team came in a week early, played Bethpage, but then they all came out to the Hamptons. And almost, in talking to Sean Quinlivan, the golf professional there now, almost every single Ryder Cup player played Shinnecock that fall, last fall, right before the Ryder Cup. So they were doing their homework. I get it. They were pretty smart and doing their homework. So, yeah, I think it helps. There's no way getting as many rounds as you can and as many holes as you can could not help a player at Shinnecock, because there is things to learn.
And look at Brooks Koepka. I mean, the fact that he only played it that Wednesday and then goes out and wins to defend his U.S. Open title at that point that's just phenomenal. Let's talk about 2018. So during the third round at the 2018 U.S. Open, you know, several players said that the USGA had lost the golf course. Zach Johnson used that phrase. Of course, Phil Mickelson had his infamous incident on the 13th green, hitting the ball while it was still rolling, which just shocked me. He took that two-shot penalty there. And the USGA eventually had to water some greens, soften conditions. So as the head pro at Shinnecock during that 2018 U.S. Open, I mean, what was going through your mind, Jack, as you watched all that unfold?
Yeah, Saturday morning. So, Annie, I'm a little bit of a hole location geek. I love to look at the hole locations when they come out before the round starts. And when I got the hole location sheet on Saturday morning and I looked at 13, I said to the guys, I said, this can't be right. This has to be a mistake. There's no way they can cut the hole there on 13. It's too close to the slope. And but I didn't think much of it. You know, we had some duties around the range, and I was really spending most of my time around the practice range in the first tee. And then I heard while I was on the range what Phil did on 13. And I was like, he what? And he's kind of hitting the ball around there, and they're not sure what the penalty is going to be. So then I went over to 13, and I wanted to see it for myself. And it was a whole location that if they could have a do over, I think they would have moved it 4 or 5 or 6 feet further away from that hill. It would have been just fine if it was 4 or 5 or 6 feet. And as it turned out, there were a couple other hole locations that day, 15 and 18, didn't get the publicity that 13 got because Phil didn't lose it on those holes. But they were dodgy as well. And I think, when the wind shifts and the greens get firm and, you have this situation where we live out there, as you've got the ocean on one side of the property and the bay on the other side of the property. The winds change daily. The wind that you have at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning is not the wind you're going to have at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And you've got to take that into account. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, I would not have cut the hole on 13 where they did, but the wind made it even worse. The wind direction of the afternoon made it even worse because you didn't really hear much about it in the morning. The guys in the morning that played shot some low scores, and you really didn't hear about number 13 or number 15, but you heard about it in the afternoon. So
about number 7, the par 3.
7, they were very careful. They mow the grass on 7 and 11. You guys probably get this word with the media. They mow those greens at a higher height than they do the other greens because of the severe slope that they have there. They notify the players. Quite frankly, on number 7, Andy, there's only a couple places that they can really cut the pin or use a hole location there. 11, same thing. There's really not four. There are four, but they're pretty much in the same neighborhood on both of those holes. But they slow those two greens down by design because you just can't play them at the normal speed.
So do you think the controversy kind of overshadowed what is one of the world's great championship golf courses? I mean, do you think it was justified?
I think it overshadowed it for that day. And obviously, if you saw the scores on Sunday, they completely went the other way. They put some water down on the greens. They gave what I would call very friendly hole locations. Ricky Fowler shot 65. Tommy Fleetwood shot 63. They kind of erred on the side of caution on Sunday, and it still played fine. The golf course was still tough. Wasn't easy. Ask everybody that played. It wasn't easy. But yeah, it was definitely a reaction to what happened on Saturday. But I think it was a great championship. Brooks, two in a row for Brooks. Great leaderboard. And I don't really think it took away from it other than maybe Saturday afternoon and Saturday night when all the talk was about a couple of the greens.
Right. Well, I know a couple of weeks ago during media day at Shinnecock, the USGA had said that they were going to take more of a kind of a hands-off approach this time. What exactly do you think that means? Because they didn't really go into it too deeply.
Well, I think what they meant, I saw those articles too. I think what they meant was, they're not doing anything to the golf course than what we had in 2018. In fact, there's not one fairway that's going to be narrowed. There's not one new tee that's going to be built. All they're going to do is grow the rough, and that's it. So I think that's probably what they meant by hands off, because the USGA does control the conditions. Like, they'll control the length of the rough. They'll make a decision early in the week based on what kind of a spring we have and how thick the rough and how long the rough gets. And they'll make a decision on Monday or Tuesday about the length of the rough, and they'll cut it at that point and then let it just play the way it plays. So they do control that. But I love the fact that they're not going to narrow the fairways again. I love the fact that there's no new tees. I'm not really sure they have room to build any new tees, because they did have 8 new ones in 2018. So I don't know that there's really any place to go. And I don't think there's anything needed for new tees for those US Open tees. So I think that's what they meant. When they said, let Shinnecock be Shinnecock, just grow the rough.
Right.
Grow the rough and and let them play. And hopefully they'll be thoughtful on the hole locations based on what they see, the scoring. You know, there were only a couple of players under par after two rounds in 218. So that alone would tell you that the course was holding up just fine.
And I know they say this year the fairways will be the widest for any U.S. Open they've ever had. So I think if I remember correctly, it was like 45 width.
I'm sure they're the widest ever because, for example, Oakmont last year, you know, I would say the average fairways were in the low 20s.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, but these are twice as wide. Now, I understand it's different. It's linksy and windy and no trees and all that. But yeah, these will be wide fairways, which is the way, you know, which is the way I think the original architects wanted it to be. They wanted to give you a wide fairway and have you pick your angle.
All right. So say, you know, it's windy and it's hot and the greens dry out. Whose decision is it to water, say, number seven or the green or any of the greens?
Yeah, the USGA, again, they control the conditions. They control the setup. They control the conditions. They control the hole locations. So it would be the decision of the USGA as to how they wanted to alter anything in either direction once the tournament starts. Yeah, they do have control of that. So it's their event. It's sure. It's the members' golf course, but it's the USGA's tournament.
And you and everybody just kind of watches and prays that it's not going to get crazy and controversial. So you visited Shinnecock recently, right? Did you walk around? Did you get to see the course at all to maybe comment on any differences in the golf course now than as compared to 2018 U.S. Open?
Yeah, I did visit a few times. And, you know, the footprint of the golf shop and the practice range, putting green, chipping green, parking lot, all that area is different. And the build out is going to be way less. You know, you saw it, I'm sure, when you look out there from the veranda of the clubhouse or the first tee, you see way, way less build out. And I think that's a great thing. You know, the beauty of the vistas are now not going to be blocked by all those bleachers and all those tents and all those structures that'll be up there. There's really not very many at all on the golf course. I guess left of number one is a big build out. But then after that, there's really not a lot of structures out there that are going to block the view. The course looked great. You know, I think we've had a colder, drier spring out east.
Definitely.
So, but we did have the rainy weekend last weekend, and now it looks like it's going to warm up nicely. So the grass will, it was really the same in 218. A month from the tournament, everybody was like, oh my God, the grass isn't growing. What's going on? And then once we had some nice weather and a little bit of rain, the grass was beautiful. So there, no doubt in my mind, John Jennings, the superintendent, and his staff, they'll have the place just absolutely perfect and just the way they want it. They'll have amazing conditions.
Did you get a chance to play the course, Jack, when you're here?
No, I didn't play. I didn't play in the spring. I haven't really been in town that many times. So I walked around a little bit, but I didn't get a chance to play. I may get out there and play possibly sometime next week, but I doubt it. I doubt
right,
it.
Right, right. Well, when I played it on Media Day, I just noticed the runoff areas were more pronounced. There were more of them around the greens and more dramatic. So I don't know if you noticed that when you were walking around a little bit.
Yeah, that's sort of been happening over the past 10 or 12 years. You know, they've expanded the runoffs and the ball does wander farther away from the green. Unfortunately for the player, it'll wander off and may in some cases, like number one, over the green on number one, the ball might get all the way down into the fescue grass. And in years past, it never got anywhere near that grass. You know, it got halfway down the hill or to the bottom of the hill. So yeah, there's, and that's, those are things, Andy, that are pretty scary to the players, because it's one thing, you know, if you miss a green and you'll have a chip and those guys can really, pitch and chip their ball unbelievably good. But if your ball is going to run off into a really, really tough, scary area, that affects the player standing out in the fairway. They don't want that to happen. They don't want that to happen.
That's tight lies. I mean, and the tight lies. One thing for it to get into the fescue, which is much lower than I can remember from years past. But the tight lies are so tough. Speaking of the build out, Jack, there is a hospitality area, a huge hospitality area on the 17th green. And I don't know if you saw it, but it seems pretty close. I mean, if I'm just going for fun and I want to be anywhere, that would be a great place to be. But do you think that hospitality is so close to that green will affect the way players may strategize on that hole, on that par three?
Yeah, the 1895 tent there on 17. It's on the other side of the bunkers. I mean, they're going to play that hole probably at 185 yards. I would compare that setup to 17 at Bethpage for the Ryder Cup. You know, it looked close and it looked like, oh my God, I can't believe they built it this close. But there's not going to be a lot of players that are going to have to deal with that. You know, it'll be loud. You know, you'll probably be able to hear the conversations and the celebrations or the whatever, you know, whatever people are talking about over there while they're playing. But I don't think it'll affect play at all. Yeah.
What makes Shinnecock Hills, in your opinion, such a perfect venue to host a U.S. Open?
Well, I think the difficulty of the golf course, the history of the place, the beauty. You know, when I was working there for my 16 years, one of the things that I did every day was to go to the first tee and look out over the golf course. I firmly believe it's one of the most beautiful first tee vistas in all of golf, because you can see almost every hole. If you really think about it now, with the trees that have been removed, there's really only a couple of greens on the back nine that you can't see. Otherwise, you can pretty much see every other green. And that's rare in this time. And I think that, you know, the venue of a U.S. Open and the winner of the U.S. Open all tie in together. Like, we remember great champions at great courses, right? I mean, we remember that. You know, those are historical wins. Jack Nicklaus wins his first U.S. Open at Oakmont, and he, for God's sake, he beats Arnold Palmer in a playoff. I mean, it's like a movie. And you know, Tom Watson beating Jack at Pebble Beach, right? Check, check, check. Tom Watson, Jack Nicklaus, Pebble Beach. So I think you remember that. And, you know, Raymond Floyd at Shinnecock in 86 was a very, very memorable, famous U.S. Open, because it was Raymond. It was the first modern Open at Shinnecock that put it on the map. And I think those matter. I think venues matter. And I just, you know, I know the USGA is going to play there every 8, 9, 10 years now.
Not only the men's, but the women's.
Yeah, that's right.
The men's at Shinnecock, which is going to be
fantastic.
Very special.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah, I love that. I love that the club agreed to do that.
Well, you mentioned the vistas, you know, when you stood on number one. I mean, there is no, in my opinion, no greater vista and place than to be on that patio of that historic Shinnecock Hills clubhouse and to overlook the golf course. And it just feels, you get this incredible feeling. It's just so special when you're sitting there. And I treasure not only my opportunities to play the course, but having lunch there and just looking out and just kind of taking in that whole experience.
Yeah, I'll put it up against any of this in golf. I've been to a lot of pretty cool places. And how about you see the windmill at National? You know, you're not only looking at Shinnecock, but you're seeing the windmill at, you know, maybe an equally as famous golf course, the National Golf Links of America, and you see the windmill there. It'll be great. It'll be great on television not to have all that built out. And I think this is a good thing that the USGA is doing.
Of all the current players, who do you think, who are you looking to do really well there this season, knowing what you know about the golf course and knowing what you know about, you know, the guys who have excelled this season so far in the PGA Tour?
Yeah, Scottie Scheffler's an easy answer because he plays great everywhere. He plays great on the hard ones. He plays great on the birdie fests. So I think he'll be – I don't think he's ever been to Shinnecock. So that'll be interesting to see whether he comes in early. I know he's playing next week at the Memorial. That'll be interesting to see whether he comes in a little bit early and tries to learn a little bit about the golf course. Rory McIlroy's played an awful lot of rounds there. He played the last Open there. Unfortunately, he missed the cut. So he only played two tournament rounds there. But he's got a lot of friends out in the eastern part of Long Island. So he's played a lot of rounds of golf at Shinnecock. So I think Rory will be, you know, I'm giving you these obvious one and two in the world picks. But other than that, I think, you know, you mentioned the runoff areas and the tight lies. I think someone with a really elite short game, sure, that's playing well, Patrick Reed, maybe the best short game of anybody in the world from what I can see, because the players are going to miss greens and they're going to have to save themselves when they miss greens. So I think a guy like Patrick Reed, or I mean, all the guys have great short games right now. Shane Lowry didn't play well last time, interestingly enough, in 218, but he's got an amazing short game, and he did play a couple of rounds Ryder Cup week last year. So I think Shane Lowry would be a good pick. And then Tommy Fleetwood shot 63 the last time anybody played a tournament around Shinnecock. Incredible. So he's got to have some good confidence and some good vibes. Yeah. So those would be some good names.
What do you think the score is going to be this time around?
Yeah, well, I think it is very dependent on how windy it gets and how dry it stays. Dry and firm and windy will send the scores up for sure. There's rarely a day out there where there's going to be no wind, let alone 4 days. But if it somehow rains a lot and gets soft, then the scoring will definitely be under par. I think if it stays firm and fast, though, I think it's going to be right around par.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in the four modern opens, you know, I think people forget in the four modern opens, only three players have finished 72 holes under par.
Incredible.
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. In this day and age with all those great players, only three guys have finished under par. So I think it'll be right around par, and I think it'll be dependent on really firm and fast versus a little bit softer.
And speaking of the wind, how much of Shinnecock's defense comes from the wind versus the course itself, the architecture of the course?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things about playing there and all the rounds that I had to play there was trying to guess what the wind is doing. You know, I can't tell you the number of days where I've been out on the golf course trying to figure out the wind, and I look up at the clubhouse because I always use those flags. Like, hey, you got two flags, one on each side of the clubhouse. And I can't tell you how many times I would look up there and one flag would be going one way and one flag would be going the other way. Like, that didn't help me at all. That even confuses me more. And I think that's what happens there. You get winds that are very, very hard to predict what the ball is going to do. You rarely have a straight downwind or a straight into the wind shot. There's always a sideways wind that you're dealing with. At least it seems that way to me. And if you look at the rounding of the course, I don't think that was an accident. I think it was designed. William Flynn's design was so that there wouldn't be direct winds, which they're not easy when you're directly down or directly into it, but it's a heck of a lot easier than if you don't know how much your ball is going to get blown left or right. So wind is a big factor. And, you know, I told Tiger, when we played, I think we were on 15 green, and we looked up at the clubhouse and I said, take a look at those two flags. Does that make any sense that those two flags are going in the two different directions? And he's like, yeah, how can that be? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't know. I can't answer your question, but they're not blowing they're not moving in the same direction. And they're on either side of the clubhouse. So
yeah, confused Tiger even more, Jack, by mentioning that.
Yeah. I completely ruined his week.
Oh my God! What about caddies? I mean, wouldn't it be so helpful? And I don't know if when the guys came, the international players on the European team came last fall to play. You know, did any of the local really experienced caddies go out with them? I mean, that would, to me, would be so helpful for a local caddy to go out there with these guys or with the players' caddies.
Yeah, well, they definitely use club caddies when they played that week. And Shinnecock does have some older veteran, very, very good and knowledgeable caddies who have been there a long time. You know, I think in prep, it would be helpful. You know, the players of today really want their caddy for a lot of reasons, because they're more than, you know, X's and O's. You know, they calm them down. They make them laugh. They know what to say and when to say it, you know, those kind of things. But, yeah, I think in the practice rounds, I would, if I were a player that hadn't been there much, I would ask for a veteran caddy to try to give me some, you know, some info that might help me when the tournament started, because we do have, you know, Shinnecock does have some really good veteran caddies.
Absolutely. Even to walk with their caddies while they're playing these practice rounds.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. I agree.
All right. So talk a little bit about the state of the game and how, what changes, you know, have you seen the most since 2018 US Open? You know, all, it's not that long ago, but I guess it is when it comes to so much is happening in golf. What has surprised you the most, I guess, with the state of the PGA Tour?
Yeah, well, the LIV, you know, we don't see the LIV players much anymore. You know, some top four or five really, really top players that we haven't gotten to see much anymore. Brooks came back. I was happy to see that. It looks like Patrick Reed will get back. But after that, I don't know. You know, the John Rahms and Brysons and, you know, other than the majors, I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't think anybody really knows at this point. There's so many scenarios. But now you've got some of these great young players who have won tournaments immediately. You know, there wasn't this, oh, he's a rookie, he'll learn, he'll get a little better, he'll start. You know, we got players coming out now, you know, in 218, I mean, Scottie Scheffler would be an example. Nobody knew who Scottie Scheffler was in 218. You know, he was playing college golf, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't anything that people were talking about. And now, you know, when he doesn't finish in the top five, it's news. You know, he finishes seventh or eighth, and it's like, what's going on with Scottie Scheffler? So I think that's been a good thing. I think these new names that have surfaced, like Scotty, as top players. And then you've got one of the things that I really love is a guy like Justin Rose at 45 or 6 years old. I mean, still contending in majors. Just amazing. What an amazing guy. What a great guy. But what an amazing player he is in the longevity. And he's played a fair amount of rounds at Shinnecock too. And I think he'll be a factor this year. I think Justin Rose will. He's aiming at the majors now. Those are his big things. He wants to win another major, and I think that'll be a good one too. But I hope we work some of this out with some of the top players that live, because I'd love to see everybody playing against everybody again. You know, someday soon.
It would be great to see Justin Rose do well. I mean, he came so close at the Masters this year and last year and didn't do it. But what play we're seeing from 45-year-old Justin Rose. It's just incredible. All right. So before we get into what you're doing now, which I can't wait to, you know, get more information about, you've watched hundreds and hundreds of rounds at Shinnecock. If you wanted to teach somebody what championship golf is all about, where would you stand on the property and what would you tell them to watch?
Wow, good question. I think a hole at Shinnecock that says a lot about the golf course is 9 and 18 side by side there. You've got two totally different holes. You've got 9 where you go straight up the hill. It's the only real straight up hill with that much slope shot. And, you know, there you really have to figure out not only the wind, but that elevation. You know, if someone shot that with a rangefinder, you know, you probably have to add almost 20 yards of slope to that shot going up the hill. And then 18, again, I think the widest fairway on the course, But you know, you want the ball down the right side. You want that angle going into that green. You do not want to be shooting at that green from the left side. I don't really care where the hole location is. You're in the fairway, but you don't have a great angle if you're down the left side. You want to be on the right side, and those would be the kind of things, you know, the angles would be important, and then, you know, gauging the wind, gauging the elevation. So 9 and 18, if I doubt there will be any bleachers or anything in the way. But if you got on the top of the hill on number 9, or you got in that neighborhood where you could watch a little bit of play or just bounce back and forth between those two holes, you know, the greens are tough. Both greens are tough in their own way. I think that those two holes really tell you a lot about Shinnecock.
They really do. And just overall, you know, you mentioned, we talked about the greens and the wind being such a factor. But I also think, you know, the slopes. I mean, you can have an incredible tee shot, but you're always hitting on a slope, it seems. But these pros know how to do that. But for an amateur, that seems to be so challenging.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you that's a great observation. Number one, that you never seem to have an absolutely flat lie. Very few holes where you have a flat lie, and there's an art to that. You know, that's another thing that you have to think about. Balls above my feet, balls below my feet. I'm on the downhill, I'm on the uphill. What's that going to do to my shot? And those are all things that just keep getting into the player's head that this is not normal. You know, this is not a normal 175-yard shot. There's wind, there's slopes, the ball's this way, the ball's that way. If I miss this green, it's not going to go well for me. You know, all those things will factor into a player when they have to hit a shot like that.
What's your best score at Shinnecock, Jack Druga?
Yeah, I shot 67 a few times from the members' tees. I rarely played the U.S. Open tees. Getting way too old for that. I did have to play them when I played my practice rounds with the players, but I wouldn't go back there. I have no reason to go back there. But yeah, I guess 67 a handful of times.
Hey, that stands up amazing in my book. All right, let's talk about what Jack Druga is doing these days. Tell me about the Evans Scholars Foundation. I know you've been very, very involved with that.
Yeah, thanks, Annie. This has been a really, really nice second part of my golf career. You know, I started out as a caddy at Oakmont Country Club in Pittsburgh when I was 14. I worked my way up through the bag room and the range and assistant pro. And now at the end of my club professional career, I get to work with caddies around the country through the Evans Caddy Scholarship. So the scholarship is a national caddy scholarship. We're based in Chicago. The Western Golf Association runs the Evans Scholars based in Chicago. And for a long time, the scholarship really was based in the Midwest. It was started by Chick Evans. That's why it's called the Evans Scholarship. Chick was a caddy a caddy in Chicago who became a good enough player to win the U.S. Open and the U.S. Amateur in the same year. And then through that, he remained an amateur. He did not turn pro. And one of the reasons that he started the scholarship was when you win the U.S. Amateur and the U.S. Open in the same year, people want to pay you to do things. Do exhibitions, write books, do clinics, and wasn't allowed to take the money. But his friends in Chicago, actually, the idea came from his mom, said, what if, went to the USGA and said, what if Chick takes the money but uses the money to start a caddy scholarship? And they said, yes, that would be fine, but the money's got to go to a caddy scholarship. And that's how it started. So I knew about the Evans Scholarship. What I didn't know was how few kids were applying for it outside of the Midwest. And I have a nephew that caddied at Southward Ho on Long Island, who was fortunate enough to be a candidate for the scholarship. He applied and got the scholarship, went to Northwestern. And in his interview, the Western Golf Association asked me why more kids were not applying for the scholarship in the East. And I felt that not a lot of people know that this scholarship is available in the East. And I said, if if you worked with the golf professionals or the PGA sections in the East, in the Northeast or the East, go wherever you want. I think they would help spread the word. My nephew applied really only because I, as his uncle and a golf professional, knew about it. And I'm like, wow, he could actually get this scholarship. So Annie, the Evans Scholarship, if a student is lucky enough to get it, is 4 years housing and tuition at pretty high level colleges.
Incredible.
Ohio State, Notre Dame, Michigan.
And how many do they select per year?
Yeah, this year we awarded 380
wow.
New scholarships, which takes our number nationally in school when school starts in August. There'll be about 1,900 students around the country in school on an Evans Scholarship. And one of the things that my role has become was to spread the word in the East so that youth caddies like my nephew would know about it and apply for it. So just to give you some numbers, when I started 5 years ago, I'm not taking credit, but when I started 5 years ago, east of Pittsburgh, we had about 30 Evans Scholars. When school starts this fall, we'll have 180 east of Pittsburgh.
Wow.
So it's really, the kids know about it now. You know, we're trying to do everything we can possibly do through the golf professionals, through the clubs in the East, which, you know, so many clubs in the East have caddy programs that the kids know about it. And, you know, we've got local caddy scholarships that are great. There's a Long Island Caddy Scholarship. There's a Met Golf Association. The Francis We Met Scholarship in New England is fantastic. Philadelphia has the Platt. There's a lot of scholarships in the East. But those kids are also eligible for an Evans Scholarship if they knew about it and applied and qualified. And you know, the qualifications are 2 years of caddying, significant family financial need from the family, and then higher than average academics that the student must have. I mean, these grade point averages of some of the kids that I've met that have applied are just unbelievable, and how great a student they are, how devoted they are to caddying. And, you know, again, through caddying, are now able to go to some of these schools. I mean, we've got some great, Long Island has got currently 15 of those 180 students caddy at clubs in Long Island or come from Long Island. So, you know, we've definitely made a difference in Long Island, Westchester, New Jersey. New Jersey has become a great state and area for the Evans Caddy Scholar. So that's kind of what I do now, Annie. You know, I work with the kids. I recruit the kids. I help train the kids. And then I help place the kids at a golf course because I still have my pals who are golf professionals at these clubs with caddy programs. And so that's kind of what I do now. And I do it pretty much in the East. I'm kind of the I-95. People ask me what my territory is. It's kind of I-95 north and south now because I do spend the winter down here in South Florida. And we've had a little success in South Florida, places like Seminole and Old Marsh, Country Club of Florida. You know, it's tougher for the kids down here because kids are in school.
Sure.
5 days a week in season. But we've been able to produce some Evans Scholars. So it's really been fun. It's really been fun. It's like started in the caddy yard when I was 14, and now at the end of my back nine of my golf career, you know, I'm getting to work with youth caddies, which has really been fun.
I love it. So the criteria is they have to have what, 2 years of caddying experience?
2 years minimum experience. They have to accumulate X number of loops. The number of loops really depends on where they live. You know, in the summer when the kids are off school all summer, it's different. If you're in Florida, you know, it's in season, the kids are in school.
Yeah.
And so the number of loops vary a little bit north, south. But yeah, that's the criteria. It's 2 years of caddying, X number of loops, great academic record, and then a financial need for their family.
So if somebody's already going to college, can he or she apply for a scholarship for like the next year or two?
Yeah, good question. The students would apply at the end of their junior year.
In high school.
Okay. With the thought of that's when they're starting to think about, can I go to college? Where would I go to college? And then once they apply for the scholarship, they're given a list of our Evans schools. We have 29 schools now. Because the scholarships are limited to these 29 schools. And like I said, the list is Ohio State, Michigan State, Notre Dame, Northwestern, Rutgers is an Evans school, University of Maryland. I'm going East Coast now. Howard University just became an Evans school, and University of South Carolina. So we've gotten schools now in the East. And it's basically Penn State, a great group of Evans scholars at Penn State for the kids in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, that's kind of how it works. But the students would apply at the end of their junior year of high school.
Gotcha. And where do they find more information on this?
Yeah, the website is WGAESF, which is Western Golf Association, Evans Scholars Foundation. It's a fantastic website. It's got so much information. I haven't even gotten to every page of the website. But there's everything from scholarship information to caddy training videos, just information, everything you can imagine information-wise about if you want to start caddying, or you are caddying and you want to learn a little bit more about the scholarship, this is where you would learn about it.
I love it. Well, continued success, Jack. Will we see you at this U.S. Open upcoming?
Yeah, I'm going to help out a little bit on the range, and they've asked me to be practice round starter on Wednesday. So I'm going to do some starting on the first tee during Wednesday's practice round. So I will be over there.
Awesome. I will. So I know where to find you. And now everybody will know where to find you.
Yeah, that's right. On Wednesday morning.
On the first tee.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing so many great stories and memories and your insight about this incredible historic golf course. And can't wait to see you at the 2026 edition of the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills.
Thank you, Annie. Delighted to be with you as always. And I'll look forward to seeing you out there in a couple weeks.
Thanks so much.
My thanks to Jack Druga and to Mike Goodsell in production. Support for this program comes from Travelers Championship, June 24th through the 28th. TPC River Highlands, TravelersChampionship.com for information. As the 1986 U.S. Open champion Raymond Floyd himself once said, "If I play my best, I can win anywhere in the world against anybody." Well, that is the confidence and belief and the mental toughness it will take to win the U.S. Open at Shinnecock. Have a great week, and I look forward to visiting with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. It's a bitter